Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 2nd, 2006, and today's session is entitled Trust, Middle East Peace in the Human Heart, presented by Jonathan Fricks, number FRJ2006-03. Let's listen in.
Good morning to all of you again. This is, in case you're getting sure you want to be in the right session, it's the one about the Middle East. And it's the third of five, and we're getting to a kind of a tipping point here, because up to this time I've been talking an awful lot, because I've been trying to focus on this little journey between facts and faith, which for me passed by three stages to be kind of basic. I think you got to understand, you got to trust, and you got to do something about it. And I'm trying to approach the project, this insoluble problem in the Middle East, with that perspective. For the recording that's going on, my name is Jonathan Fricks, and this is the session Risking Loving the Holy Land from Facts to Faith. We are here, and yesterday, with no time left to spare, we got done with what I was going to do about understanding. So I hope you all understand now. And we move on. How many people weren't here yesterday or the day before? Okay, I think the key moment was three maps we showed, where we showed Israel-Palestine, the Holy Land in 1947, in 1967, and probably what it would look like in 2007, because something is going to happen, either real bad or maybe a little better than bad, before Bush leaves office, given the promises he's made that are pushing this thing in the wrong direction. And it's a shrinking from roughly 22% of what used to be where the Palestinian people lived. They're being offered something less than 10% in 2007. And we won't go into too much of that, but how about taking some time to maybe, did you solve any world problems after the session yesterday? Would you like to share those solutions with us? Did you come to any greater understandings or greater confusions that you'd like to share? What would you have asked yesterday if there had been time to discuss and it's still with you, kept you up all night? Yes, sir.
Just real briefly, after the 67 war, how did the U.S. become the primary supporter of Israel after taking over from the British Empire?
Wow.
What was that? Well, briefly, what was that initiative?
Boy, what's the most important thing to say? Well, I'll just take, you know, sort of a real cheap shot at it. There is a description of Israel during the Cold War as an American aircraft carrier in the Middle East. And there's some validity to that. That's a, you know, it's a little bit of a cheap shot. I think much more important is the fact that this is a long project. It started with the British. We, as an Anglo-Saxon power, in many ways are, you know, we have a special relationship with the British. Maybe we fell into it without even realizing it to some extent. Maybe we were pushed into it by our substantial Jewish-American links. Maybe it became palatable to us because Israel is essentially a socialist state at the beginning, and we couldn't go anywhere near that in our mentality of the 50s. But by the time of the 70s, I think those are factors. Any part of the world was fair game for both sides in the Cold War to seek domination. And Israel was kind of a place that could tell us they were the only democracy in the Middle East. A lot of common cords. For me, the most important thing is this is essentially a piece of Europe planted in the Middle East. It's a piece of North America or Europe. It's a piece of the North planted in the South or in the center of the world. And there's so many ties to it. And then you start adding in the Christian Zionist elements, the fundamentalism, the dispensationalism that Barbara's mentioning from the Left Behind series. All of that, and you just get this incredible onion of layers of difficulty that move us towards them.
Well, so, on the issue of understanding, what's the degree to which the Holocaust still plays a major piece in understanding the Jewish mind in this? I mean, is it that we've learned that we cannot trust the world?
Yeah.
We must be ready to defend ourselves, and no holds barred.
Well. This is actually part of what today is about. And I think that if an iceberg, you know, they always say 10% above, 90% below.
Yep.
I think almost all that I've been talking about is just here. The 10% up till now. in this short 5 days we got. But it's just the 10% of the iceberg that we can see, the political, the legal, the human rights. I said, trust your eyes and your heart. And I think you can connect and understand, and even maybe propose solutions that will take care of this, and maybe this will go away. I'm not sure. But my heart also tells me that things like the Holocaust, and I think that's also part of the answer for you, when did those movies about the Holocaust start to come out? You know, for me it was The Diary of Anne Frank. The Holocaust was, and it was a positive understanding of a terrible thing. You know, that movie did it for me. My first interest in horrors of the world was in the suffering of the Jewish people. And then that went sour for me because I kept on the trail and I ran into things that didn't make sense anymore. And I got thrown out of a Zionist church as if I was the devil. They said, the devil sent you here, get out. Because I asked a question in a Bible study that didn't fit with the mentality of this idea of rapture and all that kind of thing, you know?
What was the question?
It's a tangent. Anyway, yes. It was a good question.
Can I get a tangent? Along the lines of when did this, history, I was thinking in 1917 we weren't driving cars in all of this, so oil wasn't a factor. When did oil become more of a factor?
Oil became a factor because the ships didn't have to be cars, boats, ships.
But when in timeline?
Well, they had Beverly Hillbillies set up straight on that. Black gold Texas tea,
Ben,
you know?
Jeffman?
No, you could probably plot it against the mileage of American cars. Mm-hmm. You know? There were a number of graphs. The belief in the end times would be a graph that would correlate with our involvement. The mileage we get and how many cars we have would correlate.
So is that the 50s?
Yeah. But this took a while. The oil scare, I think, has to come into it. The 1973 oil scare, where we realized that we were hooked up with this IV tube to the Middle East, and somebody had just put a clothespin on it, you know? So we started looking for more friends there. And remember, we don't only have Israel as a friend. Our friends are also the elite regimes who are profiting from the oil, like the House of Saud, and who are profiting from their keeping their position by keeping okay with us, but ignoring their populace, who have nothing to gain by Israel, and are reacting to Israel the same way you and I might as human beings. And Israel's misbehavior, not Israel per se, Israel's misbehavior. I have to be careful there. Yeah.
I just wanted to understand that comment you made about the dividing up. After World War I, I think of the four countries giving them boundaries and flags. Who was in the room when that was done?
Sir Mark Sykes and Jacques Picot.
So no representatives from the area?
No way. No way. Have you seen the story of Lawrence of Arabia's real life, not Peter O'Toole's life, but he took these guys that he had been going around the desert with to the Paris conference after World War I and tried to get them into the room. And they weren't allowed. And they knew that they had been
screwed.
S-H-A-F-T-E-D'd, mm-hmm. You know? And in fact, I got a beauty for you. I mentioned the Balfour Declaration yesterday. That's when the British Foreign Minister and the British Prime Minister agreed that the Balfour, I can read the whole Balfour Declaration to you. It really is not very long. His Majesty's government, this is sent to Lord Rothschild, one of the leaders of the Zionist movement. November 2nd, 1917. I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which have been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. This letter is coming from London, from the headquarters of the largest empire the world has ever known. Okay, the British Empire. And they're writing to the leader of the Zionist movement, which is a movement of European Jews who want to go back to the home from which they were thrown out 2,000 years previous, you know, the hope of the Jewish people. Two paragraphs. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. That's the operative part right there. We view with favor the establishment of a home in Palestine, of a national home for the Jewish people. But then there's a comma. and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, comma, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, that is, the Palestinians, the Arabs, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country, meaning you don't have to leave every other country just because we're going to give you a country back of your own. You know, you can stay in New York or Paris or Argentina. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. Yours sincerely, Arthur James Balfour. And they started implementing that right away in the agreements that Lawrence of Arabia couldn't get the Arabs into. And in fact, but it started earlier than that. When that was agreed by the cabinet, Balfour left the room and went outside, and Chaim Weizmann is sort of a leading family in Israel, and Ezer Weizmann was a president of Israel recently. They've been Weizmann generals, and maybe a common name, but I think these are from the same, you know, leading, really strong family. Chaim Weizmann wrote that he was waiting outside the meeting room while the cabinet was in session to approve the final draft of this letter. So a leader in the Zionist movement is waiting outside. He's not in the room with them, thank God, but he's just outside. And Mark Sykes, the guy who had negotiated this agreement 2 years earlier, where they secretly divided up the Middle East according to those four countries and give one to France, three to Britain, you know, the lines that were on the map today were decided by Mark Sykes 2 years previous in the secret thing. Mark Sykes emerged from the room, showed him the document, showed Weizmann, Dr. Weizmann, it's a boy. Dr. Weizmann, it's a boy. And Weizmann adds that it was not quite the child he had wished for, because there's no boundaries, there's no definiteness. It's just we agree with your aspirations for a national home. So it's all left open. And with that kicker that you can't do anything against the local people who are already there. You know, so it's a non sequitur type of letter. It doesn't make sense logically. And if you look back, it's a bloody solution in the making. Not quite the solution wished for, but he did know that it was the start of a great journey which would be laced with new obstacles, but which would also bring great results. So it's real interesting. You know what I said yesterday about fair trade with information? Don't buy the stuff that serves the people who are giving it to you. And in this case, who is able to speak? Who is represented? And we all know that's true. You know, so if the Zionist lobby was in the lobby when the British cabinet passed this resolution they had no right to pass, which then made its way into international law of the post-World War I solutions by the victors. Who talked about victors' justice the other day? Same thing. And the Arabs were brought there by a sympathetic Brit, you know, Lawrence, Peter O'Toole, but couldn't get in the room. And in the documentaries, they'll tell you what those guys felt like. They sat there in the hotel rooms thinking, this is bad, we're losing. We're losing our rights to our own land. And this is not unique. I mean, this is the experience of hundreds of peoples under colonialism. You know, did anybody ask the Africans to establish those 66 states that they're all carved up into? So it's part of that era. And another answer to your question, I keep thinking of answers to your question. It's a good one. How, in what way are we the colonial power of the day, the U.S.? Not the old capture the land and ship settlers into it, but a much more complex form of colonialism where just look at our chief export. What is America's main export? Culture. Culture. The culture that goes with entertainment, with advertising, with free markets, the culture of all of that. That's our main export. Entertainment, information, culture. All that whole, you know, the information society stuff and the entertainment, the Hollywood type stuff. Arms are big too. We're the largest arms exporter by a mile. But they are way down compared to that. And I think this is a form of, yeah, it's not, we can't call it colonialism because that's been already, that word's taken. But that helps us to understand what's going on. That's what Barbara's talking about with her empire speech. An empire isn't a helpful word either because it's too big a charge, it's too heavy a charge. If we said go out there and say the U.S. is a new empire, we'll turn everybody off. We've got to figure out other ways to describe that in more helpful, more constructive, more responsibility on our own part for what that involves. This was supposed to be you guys' time for questions. Anything else? Yeah.
I just want to, could you refresh my memory? The Arabs were asked, weren't they, by the Brits to align with them and to help in World War I so that they would be, they would then be given their own land.
Yeah, they were promised that. It's exactly, this book is parallel histories of Jews and Palestinians since 1917, since the Balfour Declaration. And they just, the texts are running like that. So they're promised the homeland themselves, and here it's given away. One hand.
Two parties are promised the same land
exactly.
by Britain. One
exactly.
who lives there and one who does not, and who's oppressed.
And then the British tried to run it as a mandate. You know, when you lose a war, your colonies go to the winners as mandates. So I grew up in the mandated territory of New Guinea. It was a German colony given to the poor cousin of Britain, Australia. They got to have a colony because they were on the right side and Britain won World War I, so they gave their little colony, Australia, New Guinea, hey, look after these guys for us, you know. And that was a mandated territory. Well, the Brits had a mandate over Palestine and Transjordan. It's what's today Israel, Palestine, and Jordan. And they had to run it with all this nice verbiage about taking care of all the people, but with the Balfour Declaration, not even in their back pocket, on the table beside, two contradicting mandates. And the story of the 20s and 30s is a story of riots and negotiations and rejection of the double game the British were playing. And, you know, double standard, if there's one word you take out of this and you want to get allergic to it, it's double standard. Double standards today. You know, Israel on one, the U.S. right now is sort of telling Israel, well, gee, when are you going to do that ceasefire, you know? When's a good ending point for this bombing of Lebanon that you're doing right now? And on the other hand, speeding up the shipment of the weapons that they sold them last fall, the precision bombs, I think. The double standards thing is, I think, the reason that we have to take courage that we're not talking crazy here and going against the mainstream. Yes, Jack?
Jonathan, why wasn't there a reaction internationally when Israel violated those borders in the very, very beginning?
The 47 plan?
Yes.
I don't know. I think because they did it, and the world we live in is this peculiar balance between crime and law, you know, violation and law, and the international law, the international community, the international regime isn't strong enough. Regime in a good sense, the regime of laws, of common agreements, of rules by which we need to live if we want to get along. It's too weak to respond to criminals. And I mean, to me, that's the A and the Z of it. It's like living in a community where the town council is useless, the mayor is partisan, and the citizens are busy doing something else, you know, not paying attention. So somebody keeps stealing somebody else's land and nothing happens. You know, what makes it work at a community level or a state level or a national level, but not at an international level? And I think that's the breakdown between the national and the international. You know, violence is avoided by the solution of conflict through rules and laws. Violence is propagated by the absence of rules and laws, you know, of standards of behavior. And so they armed, the British either gave them or let them take a lot of weapons from their own armaments as they controlled that place still in 1947. And suddenly the Jewish militia were off and running and able to break the boundaries right away and get a better setup right away in the 48 war. And what are you going to do? See, that's the other question. What are you going to do about it? You have to get an army together, go there, and put them back in their box. Well, that's exactly what they're looking at doing in Lebanon right now. Who wants to go and die for that, you know? Who's going to lead it? What are the rules of engagement? You get into all kinds of, they're not insoluble, but they're tough, tough political choices. And they'll break open the alliances if they have any differences between them. Well, you had one over here.
Well, the casualty list that you mentioned yesterday and World War II, mm-hmm. the casualties worldwide, the world was tired.
Yeah.
That's all you can say, they were tired.
Absolutely.
Don't bother me with that. I've lost this, I've lost that. And it was two major wars in a short time.
Yeah.
The world was tired.
Yeah, and Joyce was a nurse in both of those wars.
I was not.
No, she was a nurse in the second one. And she fell in love with one of those wounded casualties. He didn't like her. But he didn't like her. One more here. Carol.
I was just going to say that, and always what Israel has responded is we have the right to defend ourselves. So ever since they were given a piece of anything, because that's what I remember. I took a Jewish studies class long, long ago, and they said the borders in 46 were untenable. They were just too small. You could shoot across the country of Israel. So they've always had to do it, and that's what they're continuing to say going into Lebanon.
So they take more land and then say they have the right to defend themselves, but they ignore the fact that, that they have to deal with the land that they've taken that's not theirs. That's the bottom line over and over again. And, this is all a good segue to, for me, to be at Holden. Larry Huff, the pastor, gave me a phrase of why I like to be at Holden. I think it's a place where you're invited to break down bridges between you and other people. And remember the quote I had from the Holden newspaper for this summer, the theme I'm with you always, that thing about interconnectedness, where they're quoting Tutu? And that just keeps coming back. And I finished yesterday with the fifth of those commandments on how to understand the conflict, and I didn't get much time on it. It was put people first. Put people first. That's the bottom line of the five commandments. You know, put people first. Don't put policies, programs, all the other P's, you know, politics, plans, propaganda. Just throw that away and just keep putting people first. All people, both peoples, you know, don't show any favoritism in your attitude towards Israelis or Palestinians. But put them first. And Rabbi Michael Lerner, who issues the magazine called Tikkun, gets no justice from many, many of the mainstream people who are still committed to this untenable project of a greater Israel. He writes, there's no way to be pro-Palestinian without being pro-Israeli. And no way to be pro-Israeli without being pro-Palestinian. Because if you can't say that, you're going to pick one side or the other, and the other side is going to get screwed. So he writes things like that and doesn't get very far. And I think if you understand that and you take it and you go and look and you go and see and you let your heart think with you, your brain and your eyes, you will be overwhelmed by the fact that one oppressed group, the Jewish people, have been able to make a new beginning. And that's a wonderful sentence. Full stop. Leave it there. That's a wonderful thing to hang on to. One oppressed people have been able to make a new beginning. You know, God bless them, God bless the project, God bless their future in every single way. But it's not a full stop, it's a comma. Because the people that they have displaced in order to do that have seen their land and their way of life vanish. They've seen their human dignity crumble, and they've seen their history stop. So we have to keep scratching our heads here, and that's where I'd like to go to trust, which gets us into this issue of the ability to build bridges to other people, to reach out, to be interconnected, despite all this stuff which turns us off, and our turnoff allows it to keep going. I really believe that. We're a democracy. We have a strong Judeo-Christian roots. We cannot afford to let ourselves be turned off by this conflict, because the price is too high at every level of the human experience. This talk about trust today is, for me, I put on the title, Middle East Peace in the Heart, in the Human Heart. And I think everybody here is an expert on this session, okay? You're all an expert on this session. We're going to have a forum tomorrow night. I probably won't give you enough time to talk about it today in the session, but write down your best thoughts and concerns and bring them to the forum, because the forum is really like a town meeting. It's not a presentation, okay? Tomorrow night after chapel on this issue. And I just want to set it up a little bit for you, but I think that's the most important thing to say. We all know what we're talking about when we talk about this issue of trust and about the way that evil and violence and misconduct and injustice is inseparable from something inside each one of us. There's nobody in this room who couldn't be over there and either be a Jew or a Palestinian and behave exactly like perhaps the whole spectrum, which is really tough
to say. But I mean the extremes on both sides, which are so unpalatable. Yesterday we were on the Mount Tabor, the Mount of Transfiguration. You know, we came down with these five commandments. And as I said, you can look off to the northwest from Tabor, and you can see this little mound, which is Megiddo, the historic site which turns into Armageddon in the Bible, where the world is going to end. And I think, you know, Tim LaHaye and those guys have probably already bought burial plots on top of this for themselves. Right near Megiddo is Jenin, the Palestinian city of Jenin, in the upper part of the West Bank, in the part that's also part of Galilee. And I went there in 2002, in April, after the worst of the violence that took place when the Israeli Defense Force started really pounding down on this second intifada. And I just want to describe the scene. And I'll relate it very directly to 9/11, okay? To me, this was terror, the opposite of trust, begetting more terror, and generating a circumstance that is really reminiscent of Armageddon. If you want to take a look at Armageddon, go to 9/11 and our reaction to it. And if you want to see it in a little bit of a smaller frame, but almost a similar size area of destruction as was created in Lower Manhattan, go to Jenin. I haven't been back since. I hope they've been able to rebuild some of it. But we were going there with an aid convoy. It was the first one that had been able to get through, I think, to try to help the people there who had just been, I think, through a three-week period where, a little bit like what's happening in Lebanon now, the IDF was going after this city from which I think they have the record for suicide bombers being sent out into Israel from Jenin. Jenin had 13 suicide bombers to its credit or discredit up to that point. And so it was really going to come into, when they got it in the sights, they just pounded it and smashed it to pieces. To punish the community from which the people came. So how do you punish a suicide bombing? How do you punish a suicide bombing? International law actually basically forbids any of the methods that we have seen used. You can't use collective punishment. It's just ruled out under international law, the laws of war, for very good reasons. But that's what's being done all the time. Let me just say one word about Jenin. Jenin has a refugee camp as well as an existing Palestinian town. You can't see the difference because over the years, the tents that they lived in 1948 when they arrived there, it's just over that line that we saw on the maps, okay? The tents have turned into 4- and 5-story cement apartment buildings. And that's called the camp to this day, but it just looks like a huge sea of rather nondescript cinder block apartment buildings. 13,000 people live in it, in the camp of Jenin, and that's the part that was most smashed. That's the part from which the suicide bombers have come. And they're from 58 villages just over the line in what is Israel proper. The line I said yesterday, they'll never get back. You know, if we want to have a peace settlement, it has to be that line. So these are people who will never get their homes back and their farms back. They're part of Israel proper, and I say that, the World Council of Churches says that. But they need some kind of compensation. They aren't getting that either. And the amazing thing is they've lived their whole life now into the third generation within sight of where they used to live. Okay, so why would the most suicide bombers come from a place where 13,000 people have descended from 58 villages that were destroyed in 1948 and are still partly in view as the grandchildren are born and grow up and hear the story of where did we come from? What did you guys do when you were little? You know, this kind of thing we'd all ask our parents, okay? When I got there, there was a 12-block area, which is what I'm saying is about the size of Ground Zero in Manhattan. 12-block area that had been these 4- and 5-story apartment buildings. And you couldn't see it at first, but when you got through the outlying parts of town to the camp, you came to this core of the camp, and these 4- and 5-story apartment buildings had been reduced to, anybody work in a gravel pit? You got different sizes of gravel, you know, you ordered for your garden. These buildings had been reduced to gravel like that, the size of golf balls. The whole field of buildings, 12 acres, let's say the size of everything you can see and you think of as Holden, had been 4-story buildings, was now nothing. You were standing on it as you walked across. And it had been done partly by bulldozers, armored bulldozers, and partly by taking anti-aircraft guns from the surrounding hills and turning them down instead of up and using them as long-distance, like jackhammers. And people were living in the place when it was happening. So this had gone on for 3 weeks. We got in there a few days later, and you had on this pulverized pebbles that used to be people's houses. And you couldn't smell anything yet, but what it struck me was, this is ground zero. I had been to ground zero 2 months earlier, and here I was at this place. And I thought, this is ground zero. It's real different roots. Struggles through the 20s, the 30s, the 1948 war, you know, people squeezed for 50 years. But then this idea that some people break, some people become so desperate, they become manipulated by extremists who want to use suicide bombing as a tactic, and they present themselves without telling their families to be a suicide bomber. And I think 13 of them from that city had gone and blown themselves up in Israel and killed Israelis. And then now this city came in for special punishment when Israel decided, enough of this uprising, we're going to smash it, okay? So that's what took place there. And for me, it was the sensation. Some of you went to Ground Zero in Manhattan?
Yeah.
Some parallels, that idea of everything flattened, all these things that had been something turned into this kind of rough, you know, flat space. But this was much finer than what's in Manhattan. You know, the job wasn't finished. There were big pieces and all that stuff. But instead of dump trucks shipping it off to Fresh Kills landfill, you know, like you saw in Manhattan, nothing of that was going on. But as we had come in from the beautiful spring flowers and fields of Galilee, around Jenin, Galilee's a beautiful place. It's green, you know. Most of Israel and Palestine is not green. It's gray. It's bleached by the sun and dry. Galilee's green a lot, I think. And you're coming through the flowers, and on the edge of town, in the shade of a tree, was this enormous armored black caterpillar bulldozer in which a man can sit. And you can take shots at him with a sniper rifle, and he's not going to get hit, and he can just drive it right into your apartment building. Mm-hmm. And the apartment building can fall on its head, and he won't be killed. He can keep pushing. And this thing was sitting there resting like a bull that had just won a bullfight, you know, covered in dirt and mud, and it was under the shade of a tree. And your heart kind of, yeah. So that softens you up. You go and you look at the scene, and you just don't know how to handle the impact of this complete successful violence. There were people wandering around silently on the rubble. Groups of people, like, this was the most strange tourism site in the world, because the violence was over and you could come and look, and you're just walking like this. And then around the sides of the 12 block area, there were houses that hadn't been destroyed, but the bulldozers were a little bit off course a couple times, and so they peeled off the walls of the house towards the 12 block area that was destined for destruction, and the Palestinians were putting on a little bit of resistance still, because what they'd done was they dusted those living rooms down that were now open like a can of sardines. They dusted them down, and they were sitting on their sofas drinking tea on display for all the people who were now starting to show up and see what had happened in Jenin. And of course, you know, they're playing a bit of a game here, but it is their living room, and somebody did just tear the wall off, not to speak of all their relatives who just got creamed in the rest of the town. So talk about a strange situation, to have homes that have been opened up but not destroyed, to have people sitting there on display trying to show, we have a life, this is our place, look what's happened to us. And in the middle of the 12 block area was a woman, beautiful woman, and I'll make a male comment. Muslims don't have it so bad as we might think with all those women, Muslim men, because those women who wear all those black robes that you can't see anything, it's still amazing how much you can sort of tell about the way that person looks. And one clue is the shoes. I think they go for nice shoes.
And beautiful eye makeup.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not talking about the ones with the slits. She had a scarf, but not her face was open. Beautiful woman standing there with a backhoe, a man in a backhoe. This was the only noise. And she was telling the backhoe, dig there. So he's going down into this rubble. And then she'd kind of kick around in the dust with her beautiful golden shoes, you know. And she was not happy. Okay, I'm making a little bit of a joke of it, but. No, okay, try here. No, try here. And then she's kind of scratching her head and throwing up her hands and, you know, making gestures of loss. She was asking him to try to find her, some of her possessions, and especially the jewelry that is traditionally in Bedouin and Palestinian societies. You know, the woman, the dowry goes with a lot of jewelry, and some of them wear it all day, every day. And she had, obviously, from the way she looked, she brought some really nice jewelry.
The whole Middle East is that way.
Yeah. Looking for her jewelry with a black hole, with a backhoe in the middle of this ground zero, just one or two days after the rubble had stopped falling. You know, so that's the kind of scene you see. I spoke to one of the counselors in our project there, a guy working with a YMCA counseling center project that had to disperse itself throughout the West Bank to talk to people where they live rather than let them come to the center in Beit Sahur, where the program is centered, because they couldn't move anymore, couldn't travel. And he said he's never seen so many people at the high school talking about suicide. And I just went, suicide? Suicide bombing? He said, no, suicide. So just suicide. And I thought, boy, does that make sense? You know, I would think about suicide, I think, if I was in this situation for 50 years. And maybe if I thought about it, somebody else who thought about it would also think about doing something with themselves before they leave, which is take a few of the enemy with you. And I think, you know, we've had suicide bombing turned into this absolute, untouchable subject. I think we need to really try to explore how it can happen, because it's happening to people who are God's children just like us. You know, they're not congenitally condemned to be suicide bombers if they got that way somehow. And that's a much more kind of challenging direction to go than to say terrorism blow them away. Now, I mentioned this as an Armageddon-type theme, and that's where the human-heart connection comes in for me. I think if you take chronic mistrust, chronic fabrications, chronic untruths, chronic criminal actions, and greater reliance on the use of force to solve problems or try to pretend to solve problems rather than negotiations, compromise, all the things that you need to do if you want to avoid violence, you're on a slippery slope, which actually leads you to something like Armageddon. And you can see some, you can see the wages of sin on a societal scale in a place like Jenin, in a place like Manhattan, after 9/11. I really think that's the way to talk about this massive and stunning use of force. And I wanted to get into the psychology of it a little bit by referring to two people that I heard talk about violence in ways which I thought were really helpful. One is from the Balkans and one is from South Africa. The Balkans person was a New York Times reporter, and you might have read his book. It's a guy named Chris Hedges. War is a force that gives us meaning. War is a force that gives us meaning. I didn't ask for any books for this course because I couldn't figure out which one would make any sense. There are so many. But if you want to buy a book and read it and think about this, and have a seminar at your church about what he says, war is a force that gives us meaning. Very briefly, he writes that what he has seen in Bosnia, El Salvador, the Iran-Iraq war, with its horrendous casualty toll from 1982 to 1990, I think it was, the first Gulf War, is that way beyond the news, way deeper than anything we get to read on a normal basis, this guy who has Jesuit training and doesn't ever use the word God in his book, but it's thick with theological thinking as he writes about this in terms that secular people can understand, that violence and killing take you over, that they possess their perpetrators, and that the only haven from the insanity, from the addiction of violence, is to somehow to stay connected with other people. And he uses the word love. And I said risking love in the Holy Land as the title for this course, because at the end of the day, as religious people, we're not here to talk only about politics. We're also here to wonder, what's the connection to our faith? What's the connection to the most important things that God has told us, which usually have something to do with love? And right next to that is this idea of connectedness. Okay? He tells a story which I think summarizes what he's trying to say in the book, of a guy named Fadi Fadjic, a Bosnian Muslim. Remember the Bosnians? They had Muslims and people who were actually Catholics, okay? And some Orthodox, but mostly Catholics. So Catholics against Muslims, two sides of the war. This guy's from Gorazde. I can't pronounce it right, but you might remember that name from the bad days of the Bosnian War. And every day, this old Muslim man, he had a cow, and there was a no man's land between his house and the place where the Catholics lived. And every day, this old Muslim man would... His cow gave half a liter of milk a day. And he'd take the half liter and he'd walk across no man's land. And he'd give it to a Serb family that he knew who had a baby and didn't have any food. And he did that for 442 days. I can stop crying because that's the end of the story. And for Hedges, you know, this is a guy who writes for the New York Times, the pinnacle of journalism in our country, been to all these places, smart guy, great education, and he tells a whole series of stories like that. People he saw who refused to give up on the most basic human values in the face of violence that would turn most of us into fighters or despondents or escapees, or, you know, all the other choices you have than to hang on to these basic values. Okay? That sounds a little generic. Let's say love, you know, the idea that other people are as valuable as I am, and I'm connected to them. Hedges concludes that love is the only safe sanctuary in war and conflict, and here it gets very Jesus-like. Self-giving, self-sacrificing love as an umbilical cord to sanity amid strife. So he writes some stuff that is so relevant. And remember, just think for a minute what this means, you know. It's not about winning. It's not about losing. You know, you can be a winner or a loser. I mean, that's not even, doesn't even enter. It's something about humanity, sanity, not being dragged down into this, what he talks of as a force that gives us meaning. A force that gives us meaning. He means that in a kind of a negative way, of course. But listen to this quote. We are all tempted to honor false covenants of race, nationalism, class, and gender. They sometimes compete for our loyalty, even among them. Maybe we honor several of those. War, of course, is often or maybe always a false covenant. War, of course, is often or maybe always. We ought to just stop here and spend a year trying to figure out, are wars always a false covenant? Are they? Or are there some wars that aren't a false covenant? Anyway, he says always or maybe often or maybe always a false covenant, a sham. Sham covenants are based on exclusion rather than universality. All covenants that lack an adequate sense of humility and an acknowledgement of the sinfulness of our own cause, are false covenants. The prophets warned us about them. Another quote, just one more from this book. And this is for all those who are attacked by someone they fear or don't understand. No matter how horrible the attack, I think he's still trying to say, listen, if you can't. By accepting the facile cliche that the battle underway against terrorism is a battle against evil, by easily branding those who fight against us as barbarians, we, like them, refuse to acknowledge our own culpability. We ignore the real injustices that have led many of those arrayed against us to their rage and their despair. So he makes a connection from the wars he's seen, writing this and releasing it about two or three years ago, to some of the stuff that we fought in. South Africa, briefly, a country that's come through a conflict, pretty complex too, you know. Interesting parallels between the mentality of the Afrikaners and the mentality of the Zionist Israelis. And I went to a conference a couple years ago where people who had reported on the fall of apartheid were reviewing what they had seen and trying to understand what actually happened when apartheid collapsed in South Africa after 10 years looking back at it. And there was a woman named Antje Krog, an Afrikaner working for South African Broadcasting Commission, who had a real simple description that I think you can hang on to and go deeper if you want to. And it's pretty easy to describe it. And she's talking about a way to break these difficult structures of violence, of exclusion, of discrimination, of prejudice, of laws. And we have some parallels in our country, in our history, on racism, and we still do on affluenza and poverty and things like that. How do you break out of that? And she had three steps that she thought, you know, a good journalist boiling it down to something you can get your hands around in a couple of paragraphs. And I thought they were really relevant. First one was that, first of all, both groups have got to have their own identity figured out. And they can't talk, they can't even begin to this process until that's step one. Figure out your own identity, establish your identity. So take Hamas. Is Hamas a terrorist organization like they're alleged to be? Or are they a kind of a flawed group that's trying to, has potential to be a governing party or something? But they got to figure it out. They haven't figured it out. Okay? They've got to if they're going to be a player. And that's sort of what the ANC, the African National Congress, went through in her mind. Once you've got your identity and the other party, then you can negotiate. And she said she watched the process over those years. Some of it was secret with Mandela. You know, they'd bring him off Robben Island, talk to him for a while, and then put him back there. And then think for a while, and then they bring him again and do it again. And these are the Afrikaners looking for a way out of the hell they've created for themselves. Okay, you have identity. Then you negotiate and establish a little bit of trust. Maybe only a little bit. And then something happens, you can't go any farther, and the trust is broken, and you withdraw. And you go back and you consolidate your identity. And you come back again. You're already back to step one. Step one is get your identity straight. Step two is establish some trust with your enemy. Just some kind of trust. When step two is finished, the trust can't go any farther. Go back. You separate, reconsider your identity, maybe change your position a little bit, change your identity, and then go back again and try some more and get a little farther. You know? One and two, and then three is the same as one. Is this making sense without putting it on the board?
Yes.
See any parallels in your life?
Yes.
My wife's at the door. I thought of the lovely discussions we have as married people. You know? When we don't agree about something.
Why were you looking at that lady's shoes?
Bracken session at 3, when he told us men in secret the last 2 days, he's going to tell the women in secret today. So there's a lot of secrets here on sexuality. No. But isn't that the truth? Have anybody been in an argument either with your spouse or with somebody else where you really thought that your identity was so badly challenged you're going to have to either punch their lights out or leave them or go away for a long time and cool off or something?
Is it always tied into identity?
Well, I think that's a code word a little bit.
But I mean, I like that.
Well, I think underneath it would be dignity, mm-hmm. value, you're the child of God stuff.
Right.
You're
right.
Human.
I like that.
Yeah. And I think it addresses what they've come from because dehumanization is absolutely part of the opposite process. You can't do these things to people until you've dehumanized them. You just can't do it. And that's where, excuse me, there's so many tangents here, I just can't control myself, but what is on American radio these days? I tell you, you know, if you want to talk about the end times, talk about that. That is how you soften people up for bad, bad things. I'm sorry, I really believe that. And
can you elaborate? What do you mean talking on American radio, and which radio? There's a lot of radio.
All of it.
No,
just listen to the format that has been a business success now for about 15 years, and Rush Limbaugh would be the chief apostle.
Talk radio.
Talk radio. Talk radio, obviously. I'm not against music. The music can be bad, too. There's trash and hate on music, absolutely.
Right, okay, talk radio.
Talk radio.
But not NPR.
Not NPR, but NPR is, they're under a lot of pressure from this format to lower their standards, believe me. And you dehumanize people. I mean, this is just a huge a huge tangent, but I've got a quote here from a. Can I try a huge leap? Does anybody know who the psychologist Festinger is? Good, because I don't either, but let me quote something. Okay, this is going to be really risky. Let me tell you a Jewish grandmother story and then try to connect it with your question in talk radio. Okay. You're in the hands of a wild lateral thinker here. So. The dean of studies at Fordham University, academic dean of Fordham University in the heart of Manhattan, a Jesuit university with a Jewish American dean of studies, said, "My grandmother," and everybody, I wish I had a Jewish grandmother because there seemed to be so wise. He said, "My grandmother told me about the, here's what she told me about the Holocaust. There are two kinds of Jewish people. Those who think it should never happen again to us. And those who think it should never happen again to anyone." Now, you know, my journalism background makes me like these one-liners, okay? But unpack it, think about that. Never happen again to us, never happen again to anyone. And Festinger talks about private logic as a basis for person's behavior towards others, and what is the other one they're calling it? Common sense. Common sense being really community spirit, you know, thinking of others. You could vary, to make a huge leap, you could put love, the golden rule, love your neighbors yourself, laws that everybody has to behave according to, all the things that go with order and decency between people. You know, something where you, altruism, all of that is off in this area. But what happens with all of us, in some degree, we gravitate or we take refuge in or we become habituated or addicted to private logic. And the private logic is, here's an example. He says, you can kill a rat or a mosquito without creating cognitive dissonance. That is, you know, too much trouble in your brain. And there's probably somebody here who works in this field who should take over at this point. But common sense, or the community spirit, or this socialization that we're vaguely related to thinking of others, keeps us from doing so. To commit crimes or to kill, cognitive dissonance is often reduced by dehumanizing the other. You might remember Jack the Ripper, a doctor and a serial killer. About his victims, he said, "They're only whores." Or soldiers who talk about the others as rats. Rats as dangerous animals. Killing dangerous animals doesn't create inner conflict. The talk radio stuff is, listen for how many times they refer to Arabs or terrorists. They dehumanize other people to get this shock jock stuff going, you know. That's the connection, at least.
That's what happened during World War II.
Yeah, you see the newsreels about the Japanese.
The Japs.
Yeah, Japs, mindless followers of an empire they think is a god, you know. I saw the stuff they were putting out before they dropped the atomic bomb. You had to dehumanize the Japs before you could drop an atomic bomb on them. So that's the thing we have to pay attention to. Quote, she quotes a soldier, "It was hard, it was tough to kill those people, but it wasn't bad. If you kill terrorists, it's not bad." That's reducing the cognitive dissonance when you move from here to there. You know, this is what we're meant to do. This is what we're made to do. That is what you are driven to by many circumstances, including the Holocaust. The Nazis had to do it to themselves to pull off the Holocaust, and now the Israelis are doing something similar to pull off their occupation. And I think that line about that never again to us is way up here, you know, and never again to anyone is down here. And I think we have to really struggle to find ways to appeal again and again and again, either religiously or humanly or psychologically or common sense-wise. I love the term common sense, because the conflict we've been talking about here just beggars common sense again and again and again. Yes, sir?
Yeah, aren't we training ourselves for the private logic in that I'm thinking of specifically Hollywood? You can't see a movie where they don't have to break the rules to get even, to get ahead, to get right.
Yeah. I can hardly watch movies because I always think if we did what they're doing in that movie, this world would be even being worse. And are we training ourselves to do that?
Yeah.
And then the Terminator is elected as California's governor.
Yeah.
He's not taking us out.
Yes.
Yeah, can I say something positive?
Isn't this positive? We're fine.
A very small step, but our congregation in November, along with I think several others in the Lutheran Church, I'm not sure, our pastor and three lay people went to Bethlehem to visit a congregation over there and bring them many supplies and things. They also have a school and so on. And they have come back and talked. This is in Palestine. And they have come back and talked to us and tried to show us what's happening in their life. But just talking wasn't doing it. So the children in our Sunday school have contacted the children in their school. And they write letters back and forth to sort of reinforce these are kids just like us.
Absolutely.
Small step.
Be hard to tell those kids that an Arab is a terrorist or a Muslim is a terrorist. Harder to tell them that.
They aren't all Arabs. They teach anybody who comes.
Yeah.
But they're being driven out because money is, there's no money.
Teachers
are working without pay.
Yep. Let's have a couple more positive comments. Yes.
In our congregation, there was interest in what is Islam. Mm-hmm. So we had some people, there's a group called the Muslim Islamic Educational Trust, came and they're able to do this. And particularly two men in our congregation said, you know, I was just so aware that my heart and my perspective had been so hardened since 9/11. So I didn't like where I was going, and yet I didn't know how to be a different way.
Yeah.
I mean, and this, just a couple of times of conversation, helped them to see the human face on the other side.
What's the name of the group?
Islamic Educational Trust. It's in Portland, Oregon. They may be other places too, but a person who was able to speak really on the human level, theological questions too, political questions too, but mostly theological on human level.
Mr. Cruzado.
Yeah, there are so many anti-voices out there right now, real loud, just the hardcore anger and violence and war voices.
Yeah.
But if in South Africa, two and others could pull off the Peace and Reconciliation Commission, are you hearing voices, good, solid people out there who are able to maybe plant seeds for that in Israel and Palestine? I mean, are there any hardcore good voices out there?
There's good voices that are hardcore, but they're not being heard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to clone Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela and turn them into Palestinians and Israelis, one inch. We think that'll solve the problem. That's a secret project of the World Council of Churches. But no, you know, we're a little short of prophets, so if any of you, you know, spend extra time in prayer and try to figure out if you might be the person to lead us out of this wilderness. Maybe that's an escape desire of mine. I wish we had a leader like Mandela.
You know, I was going back to this idea of the identity and the negotiation, the identity and the negotiation.
Yeah.
And when the identity is so bound up in territory, you talk about the people in Jenin who are looking across at where they used to live, how do you get past that? I mean, what are the ways? I mean, we visited friends in Bulgaria, and I didn't understand territory until I walked with our old friend who said, who walked us through the town, and the golden age of Bulgaria was between 1000 and 1150, and since then they've been run over by everyone else because they're in the way. They're just in the way.
Exactly.
The Turks, they've been run over by everybody else.
Yeah.
And they go back to this thing, this is our time, this is our land. And I thought, you know, I don't know how to deal with this. I don't even have that kind of sense of place here.
Well,
how do you get past
it? Do you like your lot, your house? Do you have a house?
Yeah.
But if you sold it, you'd get another one, right?
Yeah.
So you just transfer whatever loyalty you have to that.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to take it away from you, are they?
I guess it depends. I don't have that fear.
No, but if you had that fear, you might start liking it more. You know? I mean, I don't think all of us can go here. We're not.
But I mean, I'm not saying I'm above it. I'm saying it hasn't hit me like that. I haven't been tied that way to land in my life.
I think we're going to get there because we're starting to build a wall between us and Mexico.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It'll be a lot.
You know what else? And here, I'll get myself fired. Aren't you the lady who said you had a rabbi who told you all about the tie to the land? The Messiah comes with
yes,
the land?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Well, it wasn't my rabbi, but we share. Okay.
Here's what I think. I think that, you know, the Bible is I take it real seriously, and I think it's absolutely the most important thing about that we have in writing for our faith and everything like that. But I think that God didn't, that stuff about them tying to that land is their spin on their story, that they are unable to separate from their religion now, and we can see the consequences. Now that's a very arrogant thing for me to say, because look at all of us. Whose land are we on right now? You know? Any Native Americans here? You know? No. And of course, you could say there weren't very many of them. There's room for us. And that would have been nice.
Private logic.
Yeah. But I really believe that the tide of the land that they claim is almost up there next to God is no different than what you would feel if you were Native American, or I would feel if I was still back in the swamps of Germany, you know, where my ancestors escaped from. So I would just say, I'm sorry. And to kill all the Hittites and the Ammonites and the Edomites and the Jebusites and the Philistines, which is linked to the word Palestina, which is linked to Palestine. Mm-hmm. In Arabic, Palestinians said Palestine. It sounds just like Philistines. So, to kill all those guys was just as wrong now then as it is now. And the Old Testament is a story of occupation by the Jews and then by the Romans. And when Jesus came along, they were occupied people too. And you know, Jesus was became a refugee to Africa when he crossed the Nile into Egypt with his parents there. You know, and they're killing all the babies in Bethlehem. He became a refugee. So all these are real stories from the Old Testament. The Old Testament is, Palestinians can't read the Old Testament very easily because of all this stuff that looks so much like what's happening to them. So here's my question, and here's where, you know, would the directors of Holden please bring the handcuffs and take me away? I don't think the gospel needs that piece. And I don't think God has a special deal going on with this one group of people who have an eternal deed to that piece of territory. Of course, if they can possibly have it, they have the strongest claim to it. But people in the Middle East have books in which they write down the number of invasions they've had. There's a monastery of Syrian Orthodox in southern Turkey. And when the first Gulf War came along, they wrote in their book, they opened their book, which is from the 4th century, and they wrote down, okay, number 38, the Gulf War. This is the 38th war that monastery had been through. So whose land is it? You know, and any claim after 2,000-year interruption, any claim that this is a God-given thing, and remember, people in this country are saying that, believing that, and thinking that should drive our foreign policy. This is sheer madness. And to tie it to your faith is even greater madness. So the only way I can get around it is to say that what I grew up hearing about, I love those stories about Jericho and all that stuff, but they are not part of the faith. Of course, Jesus had to come from a group of people, and I hope they had a home, and they did have a home, and that's wonderful. But is this making any sense?
Yeah.
By the way, let me say, time is over, so please leave without feeling bad.